Good evening, good to see everyone. Sorry. Midweek Bible study. We'll go through the questions based on what Landon read here in Ruth 1. I'll ask a brother of the church a question, and then I'll open it up for further comments to brothers of the church. We left off last time. Well, not last time. We had a review of Ruth last time, but prior to that, we were in Judges. We ended up Judges, and we talked about the war. Well, prior to that, we talked about the Levite's concubine, the terrible story there, and then the war with the Benjaminites that came out of that, and then capture of the women that came out of that. Some pretty unsettling stories. Now, this is a continuation. As we see here, it says, "Now it came to pass in the days of when the judges ruled." So we have a positive account from that time period. So the first question from Ruth 1 is, why did Elimelech and Naomi leave Israel to be part of that? Why might they have went to the country of Moab instead? And the C part of that lists some of the mistakes of Elimelech and his family made according to the law of Moses. So I found this map, kind of shows how they were left Israel, went across, kind of there by Jericho, and south on the other side, on the east side of the Red Sea, down to Moab. So my records show that Dennis answered the last question. Josh, would you like to address it?
Yeah. They left the region of Israel because of a famine that was happening, it says. And I got three different mistakes that they made while they were there. Just physically leaving Israel, I think, was a big mistake on their part to not figure it out within there, and just like removing themselves from the tribe in that region, going to a foreign land. And then allowing his children to marry the women of Moab was another one. And then after they had found sustenance, they didn't go and kind of figure out a way to come back. They stayed there for 10 years. And so that being, prolonged time in a foreign land and stuff, it seems like a big mistake. They were just allowing that to continue. So that's what I got.
Very good. Thank you. Who else would like to address why Elimelech and Naomi decided to leave, and the mistakes they made, why they may have went to Moab?
Well, I kind of, when I was working, you were always digging into the root cause. What's the root cause? And ask why five times. Those kind of drills. And so I found that first question interesting. The text tells us there was a famine in the land. Okay, that's why they left. Well, why? Why was there a famine in the land? It happened with Abraham. It happened with Jacob. It happened with Isaac. That was one of the tools that God used to try to get Israel's attention, to draw back to them. So I found that kind of thought-provoking. Elimelech might have been told by a traveler passing by that there's food in Moab. We don't know. There's a lot of different circumstances that could be involved here.
Okay. Who else? Like to address why are the mistakes he made? Frank.
The second question was certainly a difficult one there. Moab certainly had a bad influence on Israel for quite a few chapters and books before this. In Numbers 22, we see the king of Moab trying to bring curses upon Israel. He calls in Balaam and talking donkeys to try to bring these curses, and it doesn't happen. And we also see that there's a huge problem with Moab in Numbers 25, where they have problem there with idolatry. They're kind of tempting them away with that. Maybe that had some effect on Elimelech. Maybe they were questioning the existence of God or their faith in God, and they decided to try to leave there. But yeah, there might have been a deeper rooted problem rather than just the family.
Okay. Very good. And that kind of goes back to, well, I mean, you were addressing that last part, what list of mistakes. So I kind of looked up some of the, in Deuteronomy 7:1-3, it forbids marriages with Canaanites. These aren't Canaanites, these are Moabites. But in Deuteronomy 23:3-6, it says, that's where it says a Moabite shall not enter the assembly of the Lord through the 10th generation. But that ends with, and shall not seek their peace and prosperity. So you would think a marriage would be seeking peace and prosperity at that point. Austin, do you have?
Kind of piggyback, something Bill said, was talking about Abraham, other people who had been in that land when famine had come, and then departed the land. So Abraham, you remember, famine hits and that sends him to Egypt, where a whole bunch of trouble ends up happening because of a poor decision, because of a famine, and shall we say maybe a lack of trust in God? And maybe there's a pattern here where every time there's a famine, there needs to be trust in God. He never says that Abraham consulted God. Jacob did consult God before he went down to Egypt. So to his credit, I guess he did that before picking up and moving from the land of Canaan there. But it's also interesting in Numbers 26, and I believe in Deuteronomy also, I forget which chapter in Deuteronomy, 28. It talks about all the list of things that will happen if you break the covenant. And one of those is famine. It's going to be a lack of food. So this certainly fits in the time of the judges. Now, the timing of this book is of great debate. I saw something, I was studying for chapter 2, so I saw something in chapter 2 that was referencing that there's some kind of a tradition that Boaz may actually be Isban of Judges, the judge. I think he's talking about in Judges chapter 12. That this is kind of a story, a little bit about him. Now, if that's the case, he was from Judah, he was from Bethlehem. So there's a little bit of intrigue there, but it also talks about how he had 30 sons and 30 daughters that he gave out. So it redeems him a little bit, but at the same time, if that is who Boaz is, I'm a little bit disappointed that he didn't just marry Ruth and they just lived happily ever after with their only son after that. But anyway, it could be very early in that time period. Some people put it around the time of Othniel, I believe. So that's something for debate as we go through as far as the time period.
Well, given that, I didn't do a 5-Y or a fishbone. I was just kind of looking for this map and found a couple things that were very interesting. First off, I looked at Keel and Lips, which they're pretty solid commentators, and nobody knows for certain when this happened, but I saw the Isban thing, and I couldn't quite place that. But Keel and Lips, they put this back when Midian invaded the land, and there was certainly famine there, because at that last line, there was no sustenance in Israel. So that's one possibility of when that famine occurred. And then I found this slide. I think this is from a Cups and Sunday School group. And anyway, this guy had a whole timeline on the book of Judges and when he thought it fit. But he made an interesting point that Boaz's mother was Rahab. So to span this time period, he puts it back, back right after what we just got through covering in Judges at that very early time period, just simply because of the time that Rahab had to have lived. She was there at the beginning of the conquest, and to be the mother of Boaz and so forth. Even then, if you look at the chronology down to David, so Boaz, or Obed, would have been born 173 years prior to David. But there has to be a long time stretch in there just for the chronology of this. So that was another one of the interesting things there. Oh, and the other tie with Moab was with the judge Ehud, because it was Eglon that from Moab that happened to be oppressing the Israelites at that time. So this guy's speculation was they moved to Moab, you know, because Moab is ruling it, and there were some other things that were kind of interesting we talked about after services that he put in there for that timeline. Anybody else on this question? Let's move on to question number two. What observations can we make from the emotional and spiritual state of Naomi? Why did Naomi want to send her daughters-in-law back to their families, knowing they worship pagan gods? Dakota, would you like to talk about that?
Yeah, I think the conclusion we can likely draw there is that she's having a crisis of faith, it sounds like. She also goes as far to say that she feels like she's being personally cursed since she's lost so many of her family members. And it's probably possible she relates to Job in this situation where he's lost, you know, all these family members and kind of getting stricken by the hard times of life. But I think in the midst of that, you know, it's probably being presumptuous to say exactly what's going on in her mind, but probably something else that will feed into it is that she's thinking that these, you know, daughters-in-law are essentially probably going to want to go back to their home country. Like, you know, now that, you know, your husbands are dead, why would you want to trek along with me to go back to my home country that houses my faith? But obviously, to her surprise, Ruth is very faithful to the one true God and pleasantly surprises her with that. And is very faithful to her now that she's married into the family and wants to accompany her back. Did I answer both parts of that question?
I think you got it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, Ruth made an assumption that her daughters-in-law preferred the carnal over the spiritual, and she made an assumption that she had not impressed them and her family hadn't impressed them with the laws of God and where they had. Who else would like to Mark?
Yeah, I agree with what my brother said. You know, I find Naomi a very interesting person. And, you know, you can just tell how complex she is. As Dakota pointed out, she's having a little bit of a crisis of faith, but at the same time, she's not, because she's going back home. And she says about God that he has done this to me, which is saying I believe in him. And in a way, for me, it's a confession of fault. I think she's saying I'm guilty. And God has struck me and my family. And she knows that when they left, it was a bad, you know, she understands, but she probably knew at the time it was a bad decision, like all sin is, when you get into it, you know it's a bad thing, we'll do it. And she's making a confession of faith, and she's going back home to the recrimination. She doesn't know what awaits her. Imagine when they left, how terrible people remark. It'd be like somebody leaving our congregation, you know, and going away would tear your heart out. And so people were sad and weeping, and you know, maybe others were like, you'll get what you're going to get, you know. And so she's going back to that. She expects it to be a terrible experience, and then she doesn't want to drag these daughter-in-laws along with her to experience that. And so, as Dakota pointed out, there's fault there too, because if she was in the perfect place where she should be, she would have said, come back with me. If I go back and repent, maybe God will bless me and bless you, and then you can be part of the family of God. And so it's a fascinating situation. And I love, we speculated in our study about what is it that attracts Ruth. Is it Naomi herself, who in the midst of losing her husband and her two sons, who are now buried in Moab, she's still faithful to God? Or is it the Hebrew religion that attracts her to God? Because her national religion sacrifices babies. Her national religion prostitutes men and women and does terrible things to people. And so the Hebrew religion is, to her, a glorious thing. And so it's interesting, is it a mixture? Cole said it's probably a mixture of both. She admires Naomi, but she also admires more so God and the Hebrew religion that he's given us. So it's just, to me, it's fascinating. I felt, I kind of worked through, at first I was annoyed at Naomi when I started studying this, but I think I worked through that, and now I respect her for swallowing her pride and going back.
Pretty good. Man.
So this is just a random thought that I had 5 minutes ago. But I was trying to make sense of the verse where it says that they had heard, Naomi had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had given bread to the people. And I couldn't find anyone that really said anything about that. And in our study, we didn't really talk about that verse. But I felt like it has to have some importance. And I think, and this is just Landon talking here, this may not be a connection whatsoever. I think Grant mentioned this in Deuteronomy 23. In these verses, after Balak is trying to curse the people. And it says there, actually I think it was Bill who mentioned this verse directly. An Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the tenth generation. None of his descendants shall enter the assembly of the Lord forever. But in verse 4 it says, because they did not meet you with bread and water on the road when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor, from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you. And so, I mean, it's kind of a weird connection that, but my brain just went there when I continued reading these verses. And if you think about it, it's kind of like the Exodus for that family. They're heading back to the Promised Land. And unlike the Moabites, when they met Israel, they're going to receive bread from God. And then also, what Dakota was saying, Naomi is thinking, you know, she's been judged by God, rightfully so, but she's probably viewing it as like a curse, as he said. And that just made me keep on going of what I was thinking, because it talks about them being cursed. And then in verse 5 it says, nevertheless, the Lord God would not listen to Balaam, but the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you. And that's exactly what happened to this family. Naomi supposedly came, she says she came back with nothing, but they got more than what they expected, and it's a beautiful story.
Yeah, very good. Good connection. Anybody else? Let's go on to question number 3. What were the options included in the law of Moses and culturally for unmarried or widowed women in that time period for ensuring they had a livelihood and financial stability? And then what are the pros and cons of such things as opposed to our modern day systems? Grant, pretty complex question.
Yes, I'll try to be simple though. First of all, what are the options for unmarried or widowed women? First of all, their children should be taking care of them if they have children. If they do not, then there's a chance for them to remarry somebody of their husband's kinsmen. For them to remarry, so they can be taken care of that way. We see in Deuteronomy 24 that for the gleaning of the fields, the corners of them, in places that have not been kind of gone through on the first pass, are to be left there so that when the widows and orphans can come through and get food that way. We also see that Deuteronomy 25 is for marrying of the siblings to who were deceased. Siblings. And then for what the pros and cons of such a thing as opposed to our current day society. So for back then, it was a good idea because it can keep inheritance within a particular family, which was an important thing. But for nowadays, by the way, I'm forgetting what I'm looking. But for nowadays, it would be a very difficult thing for people to marry a sibling or marry with their husband's siblings. There'd be a lot of either incompatible differences between the two people or a huge age difference. But we are told in the New Testament of when somebody's unmarried to marry back into the church. So we need to keep it within, I would say, the family that way. So.
Very good. Thank you. Who else would like to address the options for unmarried widows? How it compares to today's systems? Austin?
So, a couple things. If I'm not mistaken, but this is just off the top of my head, so take everything I'm about ready to say with a grain of salt, but if I'm not mistaken, when a marriage was negotiated and the bride price was given, I've been under the impression that the bride price was partly in case something like this happened. A tragedy strikes and suddenly the woman is left widowed or left without means of financially supporting herself, and thus there is something set aside that she has access to that can support her. Now that may be totally off base, I remember hearing that somewhere or thinking that somehow. So if that is off base, somebody please tell me. But that makes sense to me. It also makes sense because Boaz in chapter 2, again, I was studying for chapter 2, so he makes the point in verse 11. It says, "It's been fully reported to me all that you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you have left your father and mother and the land of your birth, and have come to a people whom you did not know before." It's the arrangement that he puts those in order. It says, after the death of your husband, you then left your father and mother. So it's not at marriage that he's pointing that out. It's at the death of her husband, indicating that they're, culturally speaking, she was probably supposed to go back to her people. And I think that's one of the reasons why Naomi encourages them to go back to her people is and to their families, is because she knows or she feels like she can't financially support them. So, you okay?
All right.
Okay. So I think that built into the marriage covenant and arranged marriages of that time, I think was probably this concept of making sure that in the event of something like this happening, that they would be taken care of. Pros and cons, that may get into kind of some sticky things here, but I do want to point out, and I think something that's undervalued in our modern era, because what we value is freedom and the independence to go out and do whatever it is that we choose, and people look at this system and they see it as restricting. But what I do want to point out is that this system ensured that they had people around them, that they had family connections, and that families continued to grow. And honestly, I think that's something that people today struggle with. If there's a death in the family, isolation is often a cause of that. And this particular system doesn't, not that it doesn't allow for isolation, but it makes isolation very difficult. And it encourages moving on and growing new life and new families. So that would be a pro, I would say.
Very good. I hadn't thought about the bride price in this. So it was the woman's family that got it. Bride price, correct? Anybody else on this question?
Going off what Austin said, I think it's also important to keep in mind what it would have been like to be a widow at this time period. Because in our time period, of course, we have the freedom to choose spouses and that event, but in our modern society, if you're a widow, I mean, difficult times, but you can still get a job and support yourself. But in ancient times, I mean, widow was almost like a death sentence. Our, they're ducked for the job for all manual labor, you know. They couldn't provide for themselves. So I think this system is good for its time period because it ensures that they don't starve to death, you know.
Very good. Who else would like to address this? So, Grant mentioned, I believe he mentioned Deuteronomy 24, where he talked about the gleaning of the edge of the fields, which we'll see later in this book as a definite advantage to the widow. And he also talked about levirate marriage, which we'll see here. So it was, you know, this, again, as Austin pointed out, this promoted marriage and the inheritance. I got kind of got to thinking, you know, that's pretty good, but I couldn't quite figure out, you know, like if this lady had a 2-year-old son already, you know, how the levirate marriage, but this is taken care of. If we go to Deuteronomy 15, 7 to 11, if there is among you a poor man of your brethren within any of your gates in your land which the Lord God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart nor shut your hand from your poor brother. But you shall open your hand wide to him and willingly lend him sufficient for his need, whatever he needs. Beware lest there be a wicked thought in your heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, and your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cry out to the Lord against you, and it become a sin among you. You shall surely give to him, and your heart should not be grieved when you give to him, because for this thing the Lord your God will bless you in all your works, in all to which you put your hand, for the poor will never cease from the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall open your hand wide to your brother, to your poor, and your needy in your land. So there, that covered what the specifics didn't cover. You know, if there was something that by the specifics of the law of the widow, she would be covered by this. And there was also one I missed back in chapter 14. It's right there, we can read it. At the end of every third year, you shall bring out a tithe of your produce that year and store it within your gates in the Levite, because he has no portion nor inheritance with you, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow who were within your gates may come and eat and be satisfied, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. So, there was many, you know, there was provisions within the law of Moses that provided for the widow and all the poor among them. So, as Austin mentioned, the pros of this is it was pro-marriage, it was pro-inheritance, it encouraged generosity from the people, and it required some effort. You know, the gleaning of the grain, that required effort by the people, the widows who were supported. And it, as he mentioned, encouraged engagement between the people. Now, there was only one downside. Only, at least what I see. If you turn to Malachi 3:5. And I will come near you for judgment. I will be swift, a swift witness against sorcerers, against adulterers, against perjurers, and those who exploit wage earners and widows and orphans. The downside was not God's law. The downside was the unwillingness of people to obey it. And kind of like Landon a few minutes ago, I had a thought about 30 minutes ago about this. You know, if Samuel was the writer of the book of Judges, and if he's the writer of the book of this, we could have what we have there in Judges is a big showing of what happens when people don't obey God's law. And here in Ruth, we have a showing of how people obey God's laws and how it blessed the entire nation eventually. Question number four. This is for you, Trace, if you're willing. Why was Ruth so determined to stay with Naomi? What is it about her words to Naomi that shows us her faith, towards God and loyalty? And why is this statement by Ruth often used in wedding ceremonies? And are there elements of it that could be dangerous in other contexts? Trace.
I'm going to do my best. The last part I'm a little confused about. But yeah, the first part, obviously, Ruth, I think she admires Naomi quite a bit. And you can see why. I think like Bart was saying earlier, Naomi was, I think she was a godly woman led by an ungodly man in a way. I think Ruth probably picked up on that, and she was aspiring to be like that. I think she had good motives, and I think the future of this book tells us that too. I think it's pretty plain to see. The second part, I mean, there's what she says, verse 16 through 17. I mean, it's pretty. That also, you know, shows her intentions. You know, your people should be my people, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me. And more also, if anything but death part you me. I mean, and that, the last part of this question, yeah, it sounds kind of like marriage vows. I mean, death to us part. You know, there's similarities there, but you know, obviously, she's making this vow to her mother-in-law. But the last part, I was a little confused by that last question, but I mean, I could think of a lot of random situations where this wouldn't be appropriate. But anyway, I'll let someone else go with that.
I was confused too. Who else would like this? Austin will answer this question.
Okay, so are people familiar with the fact that this verse is used in weddings? Or am I just the only person that's ever heard that? Okay, I'm not crazy.
It was confirmed when I started researching it was. I guess not.
Okay. So maybe I'm putting a little too much of my own personal thought into this question, which in turn makes it a little confusing. So, I've heard it a few different times used in marriage vows from a wife to a husband. I've always found it strange, because of the context. It's not to a husband and wife relationship. It's from a daughter-in-law to a mother-in-law. So that has, I'm not going to say it's irked me, but I found it confusing. But I've also thought that it's kind of a dangerous proposition when you just proclaim and you vow that someone else's God is going to be your God outside of this context, because she is denying the gods of the Moabites and says that my God is now going to be your God. And essentially, I'm going to follow the Lord now till the day I die. Rather than just proclaiming a loyalty I would think this would be very odd to use, for example, in a wedding ceremony where someone is not a believer, for example. That would be a troubling circumstance. And that's more the context that I was, the end wording of that when I heard it this time was like, no, that doesn't actually portray exactly what I was getting at. So that's me inserting my own thought here in this question. But that's genuinely been a question of mine. So I was hoping for a little little discussion on that. Those are my thoughts, but I'll open it up to everybody else.
Well, very good. I understand the last question better, and it does make a lot of sense if you were having a mixed religion marriage. Trace, have you got something to add?
Yeah, just kind of a follow-up. I appreciate that collaboration. Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. It kind of reminds me of other vows that we had in Judges, like kind of what seemed reckless, but were just a crazy amount of faith in God, you know. I think, obviously, that's what this shows from Ruth to Naomi, is her faith in God. You know, sometimes in the Bible where it seems like someone's being just all that reckless, they're just showing their faith, and you know they're handing it to God. So that's what it shows.
I agree with Trace, and I think the point he made that it's like a marriage covenant is a very good point, because one of the commentators I read on this said that Ruth had spent time studying the Hebrew religion. And this is written like a covenant obligation. So she understood what she was saying. When she said this, she's making a covenant with her mother-in-law, but she's also making a covenant with her mother-in-law. And this is a non-Jew who understands the covenant better. That's the point. This is a non-Jew that understands the marriage covenant that God wants to make with his people better than the people. She understands it better than Elimelech did. And so she's making a formulae. She's saying, I will be buried in your people, my people. And where you go. I will follow your God's laws, and I will be buried in your land, because I believe it's the promised land. This is a statement of faith. Your land's the promised land, not my land. And so I want to be buried there. So it's, like Trace said, this is a wedding covenant she's making with the God of Naomi. So it's pretty impressive. And it's kind of pointing forward to the church. The church is made up of Gentiles, mostly, and who came into the church and became married to Jesus.
Very good. So that goes, what Mark was just talking about, that goes to the, I guess what the B part of that question is. What is it about the words of Naomi, the words to Naomi, that shows us her faith towards God and her loyalty? At least this is what I think. So there were some commentators that talked about the use of God in this proclamation. So declares, your God is my God. So that's Elohim, the supreme God. But down in verse 17, the Lord do to me also. And if anything but death departs you and me. So that's the tetragrammaton, Jehovah, the true God, the Israelite God. So she is acknowledging that, as Mark says, and knowing that the God of Israel is the true God. Anybody else?
Yes. I just noticed that Rahab said the same thing. Everything she's heard and she's seen, and she comes to the right conclusion that for the Lord your God, he is God in heaven, above, and the earth beneath. So compared to somebody who was a non-Jew, I could just apply as above his baby.
Very good. Well, we've got a short chapter, but we've only got 2 minutes left, so we need to move on to the last question. What does it say of the city of Bethlehem that they were all excited about the return of Naomi? What is the meaning of the names of Naomi and Mara? And what does this encounter tell us about Naomi's state of mind? And when is the barley harvest? Ramsey, would you like it? Logan, would you like it?
You could say quite a few things about this. A lot of it's kind of just trying to connect the dots here, but I'm kind of reminded of like a classic small town experience, you know, when you think of this. Because Naomi comes back and says, you know, they're all excited about this. You can imagine that when they left originally, you know, there was great sorrow. Dad mentioned earlier, like, know, if one, a member of the congregation left, you know, that would cause us a lot of grief and a lot of pain. So you can imagine that she's they're wondering where, what she's been doing all this time, you know, where's the rest of the family, all of these various things. As for the second part of the question, Naomi and Mara, so Naomi means pleasant and Mara means bitter. For part C of the question, this encounter tells about Naomi's state of mind. It's been alluded to that, you know, she's very complex. She's a very complex person in this chapter. You know, she's got feelings of grief going on. She's got still a loyalty to God as well. But I think it's good to point out her faith. So she says that the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me, that she went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. And she's basically, and we've already kind of answered this, but she said, you know, the Lord has kind of judged me. It's essentially what she's getting at here. And as for time of the barley harvest, I got nothing. I'll let someone else answer.
All right. That's easy.
Yeah.
I like the other parts better.
Who else would like to help?
Well, Hoffman said, suggested that the barley harvest was in April, maybe mid or late April. Back to the A part of this, what does it say of the city of Bethlehem that they were all excited about the return of Naomi? Verse 19, all the city was excited to have Naomi back. And to me, it appears that she was a well-known and respected lady. A wife, a friend in the neighborhood, that kind of thing. And this helps me to acknowledge or visualize Ruth also saw something special about Naomi, just like all these people in Bethlehem did. This was probably an upstanding family. I'd like to have a better attitude about Elimelech, but him taking his family out to Moab for 10 years, it's been interesting to hear the other side with folks seeing faith in Naomi, because I'm sitting here thinking, she's been in Moab for 10 years. Her sons have married Moab women. I'm having trouble seeing much faith here. So I appreciate some of the comments made about Naomi's faith. I wasn't seeing it very good until she comes back, and now she's going to continue to be built up. She's going to see wonderful blessings in her life. So I found that kind of interesting. And again, like Logan acknowledged, verse 21, she still feels like the Lord has afflicted her. But as has been pointed out, she still has faith.
Anybody else? Yes. Kaufman says barley harvest is in April. Clark says it's March. And Numbers 28:16-31, Passover and the first fruits, kind of the end of that kind of corresponds with barley harvest. Clark.
Yeah, so it's the beginning, it's the Passover, so they just must have experienced Passover, and what that means, obviously, the Exodus. Other people pointed out that Ruth and Naomi are making an Exodus, so it fits, they're leaving Egypt, essentially, and coming back home. And then, if you look forward to the church, 50 days after the beginning of the barley harvest, which is Passover, is Pentecost, which is when the church was established, so it's sort of, we're seeing all of that brought together, and of course we're told at the end of the chapter that Ruth is the ancestor of David, who is the ancestor of Christ.
Very good. All right, well, we're probably going to close.